And welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. So here at SimSec, we do a lot of writing. I mean, obviously, that's how we started. It's most of what you encounter when you come here. And here we have a philosophy that it's not the person that counts, but the ideas. An important caveat to that is that underlying an appreciation for an idea is you assume a certain level of knowledge or expertise in that author. It's something that you come to rely on, either if it's on the minutiae of the capabilities of a platform, or that they understand the terms that they are using and that you're speaking the same language. Some people have come to question the value of that expertise, and as maritime professionals, this is something that we should probably consider to be dangerous, because as people who operate on the sea or around people who operate with those that operate at sea, we understand that having specific knowledge is important for day-to-day operations, because otherwise people die. And if you build ideas on things that are ill-informed, people die as well. So we have today to discuss expertise and what he calls this phenomenon, the death of expertise. Did I say phenomenon? Phenomenon. So clearly pronunciation is not an expertise here. But Professor Thomas Nichols from the Naval War College, who started this with an article in the Federalist that he'll discuss. But before we get into the discussion proper, a quick word from my wife.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SimSec is and always will be free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There's a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SimSec article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SimSec is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
And we're back. We're here with Professor Thomas Nichols from the Naval War College. He's going to discuss his article and upcoming books on the death of expertise and the concept, the practical concept of expertise for those who want to deal in professional realms, deal not only in their jobs, but also in the war of ideas in those realms. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Matt. Nice to be with you.
So, Naval War College professor, that's pretty, you know, that's pretty informative right there. But as we do with every interviewee that comes on the show, I'll just open as the first question an opportunity for you to give the audience a little 1 to 2 minute bio on who Professor Nichols is. Where are you from? What's your experience? What informs, as we'll discuss, that expertise that we'll be talking about, and maybe some flavor that brings perspective. It's whatever you think is important for them to know about where Tom Nichols comes from.
Well, first, again, thanks for having me with you. Yes, I am a professor at the United States Naval War College. I think it's important to say I don't speak for them. I also teach at the Harvard Extension School. I teach courses on nuclear weapons, the Cold War, the future of war, a few other things. My background is actually I started life as a Sovietologist back before the market, back before the bottom dropped out of that market. And I still maintain a currency as a Russian specialist, but I obviously do broader international security affairs. But at the Naval War College, I teach in the Department of National Security Affairs more broadly. I'm originally from Massachusetts, but you'll notice that I don't say ca. That's because I'm out from out Yeah. I live in Rhode Island now, so I hear that one on occasion. I actually grew up out in the Connecticut Valley near Springfield, Massachusetts, in a city called Chicopee. There's a big Air Force base there, so some of your Air Force listeners might remember the good old days in Chicopee. And I had a pretty standard career track. I went to college, then I went to the Soviet school at Columbia, and then I went down to Washington, D.C., and I did a whole bunch of things there. I worked on Capitol Hill as an aide for a United States senator during the Gulf War. I did some consulting. I did some Soviet stuff for the intelligence community in the Pentagon. Pretty standard career track. And then I taught for a lot of years up at Dartmouth, taught at Georgetown, a few other places. And now here I am by the shores of the Narragansett at the United States Naval War College. It's the only thing anybody finds interesting about me. I'm also a 5-time undefeated Jeopardy champion.
Apparently people on Twitter think that disqualifies you to talk about things. Like, oh, well, look at this guy. Who's this Jeopardy winner? Like, hey, who won Jeopardy? You didn't.
Mr. Smarty Pants. It's a strange thing. I mean, I've gone off and given talks where I've been introduced and people say, well, he's a professor, he has a PhD, he's written all these books, he's done all these things, and everybody sits there and then they say, and he won on Jeopardy, and the whole room starts clapping. So it's always a pretty humbling thing to find out that that's the only thing that people, I suppose because it's television, and for most people, things aren't real until they're on television.
Like I said, apparently that makes you unreal to some people, that your success in Jeopardy, which they have never won. But I won't start the rant, obviously. We'll move on to some more substantive questions.
It is related to the thing we're going to talk about, which is that people I think people sort of push back immediately whenever they think they're confronting somebody who's smarter than they are. Because in our modern society, nobody's supposed to be smarter than anybody else, which – as you pointed out in your introduction, if that were the case, then a lot of people would die, because obviously if you're sitting in the back of an airliner, you want the pilot to be better at flying an airliner than you are. But we've become a very strange society where we are ruled by this false notion of egalitarianism, where we think that everybody has to be as smart as everybody else, and it's rude to point out any differences among us that way, which I just find so deeply disturbing.
And that was the topic of your article at the Federalist, The Death of Expertise, and that went around a lot. Very popular article.
It went viral. I mean, the publishers of the Federalist, which magazine I obviously highly recommend as a senior contributor at Federalist, I highly recommend it to your listeners. They saw it as a when it was a blog post on my old blog, and they asked to pick it up, and I reworked it and worked with their editors, and we put it up there, and it has since been seen and read, and I don't mean hits, I mean individual people, well over 1 million people have read that article, which I find astonishing. You know, you spend your whole life as an academic, you like to do outreach, you work with the public, you give lectures, and then you find that one rant that you put on the internet suddenly has been read by over 1 million people around the world. It's been translated into several languages. I've gotten fan mail from Europe and Asia. It's a very, very strange phenomenon, but
to be fair, I hit the nerve. It's far more eloquent than a common rant, but it is surprising how rant-like objects do become so popular, but it's because it touches a certain chord that I'm sure many people have encountered in a very frustrating way in professional circles. But let's jump into that proper. So you've introduced a lot of these ideas because I failed to ask a good opening question. So you jumped it. There you go. There's my lack of expertise as being a real host of any kind and not just a guy on a headset. But what made you sit down and say, I have to write this article? I mean,
it's a great question.
There's an unending stream of this stuff on Twitter of, you don't know what you're talking about. Who's the smarty pants guy? I sit behind my keyboard. I'm 700 pounds and I never leave my house, but I'm an expert on nuclear deterrence. What finally was what was the last straw?
Well, that's a great question, Matt. So there you go. You actually are an expert interviewer, because that's a terrific question to start with. Like all good pieces of opinion journalism, I think, or like so many good pieces of opinion journalism, it happened because I was pissed off. It had actually been building for years. You know, I got asked a lot, well, is this just because of Twitter or Facebook or social media? And as trendy an answer as it would be to say that it really is about the internet, it's really not. The first time I ever asked this question, I was working at a company about 30 years ago in Washington, and I was doing some contracting work. And when I would tell people, well, I'm a Soviet guy and I speak Russian and I work on Soviet stuff, inevitably somebody would say, oh, you're a Soviet expert? Let me tell you about the Soviet Union. And I finally asked one of my supervisors, I said, you know, what is it? Why do people do that? And he just shook his head. He said, you know, everybody's got an opinion, especially when it comes to foreign policy. And they think their view is as good as any other. And I sort of wrote that off and said, well, okay, that's just how it is when it comes to politics, because, you know, everybody wants to talk about politics. What I found over time is that it's something that people do about everything, whether it's politics, whether it's public policy, whether it's science, medicine. Some of the biggest fans of the article that I've encountered over the years have been doctors who have been so, they say, thank you for writing this piece. You know, I'm so tired of people coming to my office and explaining to me what's wrong with them instead of letting me do it. And I found that a lot of professionals have read the piece and sent me mail saying, boy, I'm a lawyer and I wish my clients would stop arguing with me about the law. I'm a doctor. I wish people would stop arguing with me about vaccinations. I'm an engineer. I wish people would stop telling me how to build buildings. And the immediate spur, to go back to your question, was this actually arose during the Snowden, the Edward Snowden business.
Oh, God.
Where I was talking, you know, I have a colleague, had a colleague here at the War College who's a former National Security Agency guy. We were trying to explain to people on social media and on Twitter to say, look, this is really a bad thing. You know, this is a dangerous business. This kid is obviously in over his head. And people were saying things like, well, you don't really understand classified information, or you don't really understand the National Security Agency. And we were all kind of looking at each other saying, this can't be real. This can't be, you know, 20-year-old guys, as you say, sitting in mom's basement with a bag of Cheetos explaining to middle-aged men how they don't understand how the National Security Agency works. And I just found it astonishing. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought about all the years of this kind of happening, of people explaining Russia to me, or people explaining nuclear weapons to me, or people explaining the National Security Agency. And so I just sat down. I actually got the title from a colleague of mine who had mentioned it over dinner once. And I kind of banked it out and I put it up on my blog and I forgot about it. And a lot of people read it. They liked it. And then the editors from The Federalist contacted me. And the rest, as they say, was history. At that point, it went viral. And I was eventually, about a year and a half later, I was contacted by Oxford University Press, who suggested they invited me to submit a proposal for a book. So this summer, it'll be a longer book. I'm sure a lot of people will disagree with a lot of it, where I try to explore this a little more and ask why this happened, and, you know, why people feel they can argue with experts when they really don't know very much at all. And we'll see what happens. The book's due out in probably late August or early September.
And I think, you know, I think part of the crux of the question is sort of parsing out exactly what is the nature of expertise, because there is a difference between an expert and then someone coming up and saying, I disagree with you, expert, based on A, B, and C, and you may say, as the expert, interesting, I don't agree, but you clearly have done some sort of research or you have some sort of experience in the field,
right.
And I disagree with you because YOLO Illuminati. Where do you see, and this will happen a lot in the field of sort of amateurs, and I use the word amateurs, but we're a mixture of professionals, and it's a mix of operational experience and some academics here on the blog, but we're not, you know, we don't work at CNA, you know, that kind of stuff. Our entire life isn't theory or strategy, and What is the difference? Where's that crux, that sort of edge that says, you know, here's expertise, here's right. people with new innovative ideas. How does expertise interact with that? Because the expert knows a lot of things, and the guy with the new ideas may not have that experience, but he also, hopefully,
these are both very good questions. What you're really asking are two separate questions. One is, what's an expert and how do you know when you're dealing with an expert? And the other is, how do new ideas penetrate from non-experts to expert? Because
this is why you're the expert.
Yeah, because that's
two
that's
very
really
good questions. Yeah, more well worded than mine.
Well, it's of course, you know, don't forget I've been spending 2 years sitting around thinking about this. First, on the question of what makes an expert is not a hobbyist. This is a huge difference. You see it, for example, I'll illustrate by way of telling a story. When I was chairman of the strategy department at the Naval War College, we do case studies of war, and I swore, as long as I was sitting behind that desk as the chairman, that we were never going to do the Civil War as a case study, because, of course, so many guys in the military are hobbyists about the Civil War. They know a lot about it. They've read endless books. They do field rides at Gettysburg. You know, they have a lot of intricate knowledge. That doesn't mean they are professional historians of the Civil War. And this is a really hard thing for people to grasp, that you can read a lot about a subject and be very well read on it, but it's not something you do every day as part of your professional identity. You're not subjecting your views to the judgment of your peers, for example. You are not keeping up with the literature in your field. You're a hobbyist. You have interesting ideas. You've learned a lot of stuff, but it's synthetic. It's secondhand. You are not the original creator of that kind of material. You know, one thing a lot of people don't understand about having a doctorate, for example, one of the accusations I got a lot when this article came out and while I've been working on the book is, oh, you know, you just defend people with degrees because that's credentialing. Well, to some extent, that's a fair cop, you know, that just because you have a degree, there are a lot of stupid people wandering around the world with master's degrees and doctorates. But in most fields, a doctorate means that you've shown the ability to make original contributions to the body of knowledge in your field, that you actually can design and execute an independently created research project. That's very important. That's different than saying, look, I've read every book there is about Gettysburg, so I know a lot in a very descriptive way about Gettysburg. That's different than saying, I can do original research and frame this and discover new things or recreate a lot of this knowledge in a way that's accessible. So that's one issue about experts. Experts are part of a profession. They are self-policing. They have kind of codes of evidence and rules that they deal with. But your second question is really important. How does someone outside that break into that circle? How does somebody who has a flash of inspiration, for example, about how to do something better, tell doctors or engineers or lawyers or whatever it is? Well, part of that, I think, involves a certain amount of humility on the part of the non-expert, because what really I think is surprising is how many people say, well, I'm just as much an expert as you are, and I have this idea. Start from the assumption that you're not an expert, but that you may have stumbled onto something, and then do what we do, which is to present your ideas for review and for serious kind of peer consideration. I think people who come from outside of a profession, outside of being professionals or being kind of card-carrying experts, think that if they have a great idea that no one's ever thought of it before, and if you object to it, you're simply just defending your turf. And that is really maddening. I can't tell you how many times as a educator, for example, over the course of 30 years, people have said, well, have you ever thought about teaching this way? Well, yeah, I have. It's occurred to me before. I had a career before I met you, and I think that doesn't mean that you can't come up with a new idea. It doesn't mean that you can't discover something, but I think most people should understand that first, it's pretty rare that happens. Most advances in knowledge are not you know, the guy who suddenly, you know, trips over the solution to Fermat's last theorem. And also that if you're going to approach experts about this, you have to understand that they operate on certain rules of evidence, and simply saying that you don't care about that is not going to cut a lot of ice with those experts. You know, when people go to their doctor, for example, I've been asked this many times. Oh, so what you're saying, Tom, people should never question their doctor. They should never argue with their doctor. And I say, you know, there's a huge difference between being an informed patient who knows how to ask questions and marching into your doctor's office and saying, let me explain, you know, bone cancer to you. Those are two very different approaches. The first, in that first one, the doctor's going to say, fine, I'm here to answer your question. In the second one, he's going to tune you out. He's going to say, look, I'm an oncologist. I do bone cancer for a living. You're probably not going to tell me anything new. So I think one important thing for people dealing with experts is be educated enough to know what you're talking about, but also be humble enough to realize that what you ought to be doing is asking questions rather than delivering lectures.
So what you've described seems to have, I mean, this is the theoretical. So there's a very cut and dry, but a lot of what we will encounter, you know, stuff linked on social media, stuff that's written up in blogs or in articles, is somewhere riding that line between hobbyist and expert. Because you'll have, for example, let's say a Senate staffer, right? They've never written anything for peer review, but maybe they spent 10 years working for the HASC, or I'm sorry, for the SASC. Or maybe you've got something, for example, you've got somebody who is not myself, of course, but let's say there's a lieutenant in the Navy out there, and he's done Riverine. Yeah, we'll make him different than me. So he's a Riverine guy. Now, he's never written anything for peer review, but he's going to go up and he's going to write an article, and he's going to reference something from the Peloponnesian War, and it's going to be about Riverine operations. What would you describe kind of – and I'll say what we, in quotes, we being the folks that aren't, you know, the lifetime Sovietologists or the lifetime Civil War experts, what would you describe is that, would you say that is a type of expertise? Would you say that's an extremely expert type of, you know, hobbyist? Where do you kind of draw that line?
Everybody's good at something. And, you know, for example, when I go to get my hair cut, right, and the woman says, what kind of shampoo do you want me to use? I say, you're the beautician.
Yeah, I say the same thing. Yeah.
You know, I have a vague idea that I want to look better than I did when I walked in, but I don't have the background or the experience. I advised the senator during a war, but I wouldn't pick up a pair of scissors and approach somebody's hair. I mean, it just, there is a division of labor in the world, and everybody's good at something. Everybody's an expert at what they do. If you're a lawyer, you don't tell your plumber how to do things. I said in the article, I had my house rewired. I bought a house a few years ago, and I had the whole house rewired. And as far as I'm concerned, what electricians do is indistinguishable from magic. He walks around and says, well, we're going to put this here, and we're going to put that there, and we're going to run this conduit. And I nod as though I have any idea what's going on. I'm like, look, you just do it, and I'll write the check. Now, where I think it becomes a problem is when experience and expertise try to find some kind of common ground. Because, you know, I can give you a lecture on Clausewitz and do that pretty well. And then, you know, an infantry colonel, I've had this happen, walk up and say, you know, that was all very well and good, professor, but let me tell you something. I was out there in the shit, and I was out there, you know, humping it, and I know how all this stuff. I think the problem is people put those two kinds of knowledge in opposition to each other when in fact they're complementary to each other. People who have experience have something to add to the conversation. The people who integrate that experience and can broadly integrate a lot of different people's experience, that's what makes for an expert. Because I think one mistake that a lot of people make is to generalize from their personal experience. And this is the problem, and I talk about it in the book. This is the problem of confirmation bias. You know, you make a generalization. As an expert, you say, for example, People in China tend to be shorter than people in the United States. And somebody will always say, yeah, but what about that Yao guy who played basketball? Well, okay, so there's one guy from China who's 7 feet tall. That doesn't mean anything. And people get very upset about that because they say, but I know something. I saw a Chinese guy who's 7 feet tall. And again, it's that kind of arrogance and narcissism that says, what I know is more important than what anybody can tell me. And I think that that's always a problem. I think, you know, when people in my classroom, for example, talk to me about things they've done out in the field, I never contradict them. I have no operational experience like that. When they talk about what it was like to ride a tank across a rock, that I soak that up because it's interesting to me. When it comes to my area, which is how do you make strategy meld with operations? Well, then that's what I know. And it's always important to not try to get in each other's soup about being smart in one thing or having experience in one thing makes you smarter experienced than everything.
You know, it's, I'm glad you brought up, actually, I'm not glad you brought up that example because, it took away my opportunity to ask the question, but I'll use the vignette anyways. I do have a friend, very much a Sparta-like, gentleman in the Marine Corps, he and I have regular debates about the value of civilian academics. I am a fan, you know, of course, with the grain of salt driven by the interchange that you describe, because, you know, you say trying to stay out of each other's soups, but I think to a certain point that's impossible. Just because of the way that experience in the military field is split up. You have a long-time professional. He's not going to be an academic. He may be well studied, but he's not like a Sovietologist. That's not what somebody who's a ground pounding, you know, infantry leader has done. On the other side, the guy who is the Sovietologist doesn't have that. And if they want to come together on that operational level, you know, tactics and operations, operations and strategy, they're gonna be in each other's soups. But he and I have had regular debates, and he's very much of the Starship Trooper mindset. Where,
yes.
If someone hasn't been in the field, please don't talk to me, which is great.
I use that example all the time. And when people on Twitter give me that about, you know, when we're talking about foreign policy and somebody says, well, you know, I carried a rifle for 10 years. And I say, well, you know, I Starship Troopers, right? Service guarantee citizenship. I think it's unfortunate because, sure, there are a lot of, you know, annoying academics in the world, and there are a lot of military officers who are just rigid martinets. I mean, we can play with those stereotypes all day. What civilian academics do, and I would argue that, you know, the reason professors ought to exist is that we think about the things that other people don't have time to think about in their daily life. Where, you know, when we talk about, for example, civil-military relations, the military never thought about that. I mean, that was not that field didn't even exist until the 1950s, really. That expression didn't even exist. And the pioneer in that field was, of course, one of my old teachers, the late Samuel Huntington of Harvard. Now, you can say, well, what good are civilian thinkers? Well, first of all, civilians run the world. This is something I think military people, you know, sometimes lose sight of, is that when you ask, well, why should we, you know, why do we care what civilian thinkers think? Well, because in our system of government, civilians run the military and they run the country. And, you know, if you want to think deeply about what the relationship between civil and military elites ought to look like, and you haven't read Samuel Huntington's book, then in my view, you just haven't thought deeply enough about it. And I think that there's a value to doing that. I think that one of the challenges I've encountered in teaching military guys for almost 20 years now is they're comfortable with what they're very good at, which is operations. And that expertise, again, nobody's better at that than the U.S. military. But that is not the same thing as strategy or policy. And that is a different kind of expertise. Knowing how to move 1,000 tanks across the desert is not the same thing as knowing why to move 1,000 tanks across the desert. It's not the same thing as, you know, being fluent in Arabic or Russian and knowing what your enemy is thinking. And I think that there are people in the academic community who try to become posers and pretenders about operational knowledge and try to pull out their maps and pointers and be armchair generals. And I discourage that as well from them. I think that's a stupid thing to do. But likewise, when I see operators saying, well, you know, let me explain to you, you know, how we should fight the war on terror, I bristle. There is no question about it. I bristle somewhat because I think, you know, we all bring different things to the table, and it's okay to do that. I also think, and I'll just, I know I've been going on here, but
please.
There's a general, not just in the military, but in American society, there's a very strong anti-intellectual streak, which is to push back against people. I've had people be critical of me just because I have professor in front of my name. I've had people say things like, well, of course, you're a professor, as though that's almost, you know, like, well, of course, you're an extortionist or you're a mafioso or something. And I think it's just, again, that kind of notion of egalitarianism that says that nobody's smarter than anybody else, when in fact we live in a world where everybody, you know, we're all smarter than somebody else in something.
You know, there's two great examples here. One is, you know, you just reminded me, going into JPME, Joint Professional Military Education, for the acronym Uninitiated, is you'll go into something like a scenario, and some will say, well, this is how we'll deter this enemy. And before we've even read the section on the political background or where they come from, and you say, well, I think this guy's actually a little bit more like ISIS. It's just the government. And you're like, how? You can't just take rote operational concepts and apply them to an enemy without context, because you don't know how they react. And we've seen in history how poorly that ends when you use that in a war fighting scenario. But also, to kind of look at that academic to operational level, certain dalliances within government, someone says, well, I don't understand the classification system. I don't see why this is wrong. It seems like convenience. And then someone says, no, you don't understand. I use the classification on a daily basis. This is like setting your boss's car on fire and killing his dog. Like, you don't understand how bad what just happened was. You know, maybe setting up a private server in your own bathroom. You know, like, and people say, but I just don't get it. So because it doesn't make any sense to me in my theory of the world, you know, this seems like just something that someone
That is the most infuriating thing in the world. And I think you picked a really good example here of the classification issue with Hillary Clinton's server. People say, well, I don't get why this is important, so therefore it's not important. Well, that is, again, a kind of really grating arrogance among lay people that says, if I don't understand it, therefore it couldn't be important. Well, there's a lot of things that you don't understand that are nonetheless important, because you can't understand everything. No one can. You know, if it's, again, it's like sitting there while your doctor is working on you saying, well, listen, I don't understand why you're doing that, so it can't really be that important. You know, or arguing with a firefighter, you know, point the hose over there instead of over here. Get out of the way and let the professionals do their job. And I think that is I think a lot of it comes out of our every kid gets a trophy culture, where, you know, kids just are never told that they're wrong. There's a story I tell that I've been telling for years that I've put in the book. Years and years ago, there was an astrophysicist, a very well-known astrophysicist at Dartmouth College, and he was arguing with a student about missile defense. And after enough time went by, the kid finally gave up, and he started to sit down, and the kid said, your guess is as good as mine. And this professor stopped him cold. He said, no, no, no. He said, my guesses are much, much better than yours. Yeah. Meaning, you know, we can all have an opinion about it, but when it comes to an educated guess or an informed view, the expert is probably going to be more right than you. And simply saying that you don't understand it or you don't see it, it's a meaningless thing to say. But people do it all the time because that's how we argue in America now. The three words I dread for years in any discussion is when somebody begins a line with, I just think, because what it means is anything that follows is going to be totally impervious to argument.
So speaking of educated guesses, let's kind of look quickly in the lens of expertise through a moment in your life, the educated guess where no one thought that the Soviet Union collapsed and then suddenly it did. You were at the time a Sovietologist. So you were an expert in a place that ceased to exist. What was that like, and how did you what was it like being an expert in a thing that didn't exist? I mean, pieces of the Soviet Union, it's not like the entire chunk of land disappeared, but what was that like for you, someone who had sort of gone to a school dedicated yes. to this concept, and now it was gone?
I still have a degree on my wall from the Harriman Institute for the Advanced Study of the Soviet Union. And, you know, it's this is a place, just to relate it back to expertise, where the experts, to use the technical term, screwed the pooch. And en masse, the experts in my field, I just simply did not see this coming. And people who were not intellectuals, there were a lot of kind of average Soviet citizens and dissidents, they saw it coming. And we didn't believe them. So it is true that experts can get things really wrong. Look at the I don't know when your listeners will be listening to this, but as you and I are talking, it's the day after the Iowa caucuses. Look at how wrong the experts were there. They got Donald Trump's share of the vote wrong by 10 points. I mean, it was a 10-point swing. It can happen. Experts can be wrong. I went to the old Soviet Union 3 times before it collapsed, and then I went several times afterwards. And it's just to answer the second part of your question, it's a hallucinatory experience. I mean, it is. I almost feel bad for people who didn't see it, because to understand how much things have changed, you had to have seen both periods in history. I imagine it's like people who saw Berlin in the 1930s with, you know, swastikas all over the place. I spent years in the Soviet Union visiting the Soviet Union, where I saw red banners and statues of Lenin and hammers and sickles, and then came back to find, you know, ads for American Express and Perrier and sushi bars. So it was a pretty strange thing. And part of the part of my own development as a scholar, I think, was to really be careful about ever making those kinds of categorical predictions again. Because I come from a group of intellectuals and experts who really got one wrong in a big way. You know, just to add to your question about operational ability and expertise, the people who weren't Soviet experts but who were hobbyists, the people I call hobbyists, who read a lot of Russian, they read a lot of books, they didn't get this any better than we did. And I think that's also part of the problem, is that those folks can only be as smart as the research they're reading, which is another limitation on the kind of the hobbyist approach to something. You know, you're reading books, and when people say, I've read a lot of books about the Civil War, well, those are only as good as the people who wrote those books. And the same happened with Russia. You know, if you've spent, the last thing I wrote was on nuclear weapons, and it's, you know, again, a place where we're doing a lot of rethinking among experts. If you spent years commanding nuclear weapons or sitting in a silo, you can tell me all about the operational characteristics of nuclear weapons, which direction the key turns, you know, how long it takes to get from one station to another, things like that. What you can't do is speak in detail about nuclear strategy, because it takes a long time to internalize all that stuff. And it took the Soviet guys a long time. And we're 20 years after the Soviet collapse, we're still talking to each other and saying, now, you know, how did we screw this up? And that's what experts do, is they do long autopsies on their own mistakes, because sometimes we learn more from that than anything else.
You mentioned that, you know, some of the dissidents and folks like that, they saw it coming. What would you consider them? They're not necessarily Sovietologists, but they're from there. It's like someone from Iowa. They're from Iowa, and maybe they have a better sense of things. So in the world of hobbyists and experts and amateurs, what do you call that guy who's, I don't even know how to describe it.
No, I call them a primary source. I think what scholars and experts do
transcend expertise. He is the expertise. He's the subject of study, then, is what you're saying.
If somebody in Iowa, for example, says, you know, if somebody in Iowa had said a week ago, you know, I know the polls are all saying this, but I'm not feeling it. You know, I'm not feeling a Trump win. Or if you went to Russia and there were people who said, you know, this system isn't going to last another 10 years. First of all, everybody can get one right and get lucky. What you do, though, in those cases is you start asking other people and you start trying to systematize that knowledge. So, well, you know, as you know, I was in actually the same thing's happening in New Hampshire right now, that where Trump is ahead by a significant margin. And there are people, there was a piece in the New York Times the other day where a lot of New Hampshire Republican officials were saying, I know, I see the polls, but I don't believe them because I don't feel it. I'm not seeing it somehow. Well, you know, that's an interesting point, and it's worth researching. The difference, I think, the problem is any one person can you know, throw a dart at a board and hit a bullseye. Can you do it over and over and over again? And I think that's the difference. It may well be that, you know, there may have been somebody walking around in Iowa saying, you know, I'm just not feeling a Trump win. And they turned out to be right. But they could have been right for the wrong reasons. They could have been, it just so happens that nobody in their family was voting for Trump, or the dissident that you're talking to just happens to hate the Soviet system, and his prediction of a collapse was built on hatred rather than reasoning. That's what scholars and experts figure out, is how to take that raw material of people observing things and turn it into something more systematized, something more usable as a generalizable form of knowledge.
You know, the second you said trying to systematize it, the first thought that popped into my head was, wait, you mean like a poll? I thought those didn't work.
Well, but yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes the polls don't work, and polling is an inexact science. But I'll tell you what, if polling didn't work, and if systematizing those kinds of questions about human preferences didn't work, the whole field of advertising and marketing would fall apart. And it doesn't. Companies pay good money for advertising based on polls and focus groups and other similar mechanisms. Why? Because they work. I'll give you an example directly. Perhaps you saw it just before the Iowa caucus. Ted Cruz sent out a mailer, and it was one of these kind of looks like official mail, fake mailers. You know, you haven't voted enough. Your grade as a voter is an F. And there was this huge outcry. Oh, you know, this is going to backfire and nobody believes those things and they're terrible. Well, there's actually a very long piece from about 7 or 8 years ago in, of all places, the American Political Science Review. And it's dry and it's boring and it's full of numbers. But the bottom line is what all political marketers know, that negative direct mailing like that actually works. It actually drives up turnout for your guy. And that's why people do it. They spend a lot of money on it, and there is science behind it. So, you know, can the polls get one wrong? Sure. But again, what's the difference between an expert and a layperson? The expert is more likely to be right more times in a day than you are.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up that mailer because there was some of that stuff in it that was also brought up in a Freakonomics podcast, specifically because they use statistics from the neighbors on it. And it was a discussion of what's more likely to get you to do something because it's of a vague social good. Like, hey, don't, you know, water your plants too much here in California because it's bad, versus, hey, the rest of your neighbors are saving water and you're not. And they found that stuff that relates you to the people in your immediate vicinity is much more powerful.
Absolutely.
And exactly. And that's kind of how those mailers work, because it wasn't just, hey, you're not doing what you're supposed to do as, you know, participant in the civic process, but here's a list of all your amazing neighbors who are clearly much better voters than you are.
Now, well, I'll give you another example that's not related to politics, but again, based in the science that this works. I don't know how it works where you live, Matthew, but where I live, the power company every few months sends me a letter that says, here's how your energy consumption compares to your neighbors. You know, people who live on your street or in your area. And of course, my power consumption is always higher than my neighbors. And it's clearly meant to shame me into using less power. And I always look at it and I go,
wait, why? They want you to spend money on power, right?
They want me to be energy efficient. They want me to use LEDs and, you know, they're all about conserving power. And they send you this mailer. And of course, no matter what you do, I mean, you could sit here in the dark, they're still going to send you a mailer that says you're using more power than your neighbors. And I will be the first to admit, I always throw it away and I sort of roll my eyes. But for one moment, I look at it and say, why am I using more power than my neighbors? It works. And as you know, it may be icky, but it works. And the problem is, again, going back to confirmation bias, individuals who see these things say, well, it didn't work on me. Well, this is that narcissism of American society where you always want to say the whole world isn't you. You know, that people in large numbers do act predictably. And, you know, there's a reason that people do this. So this generalization of I think, I believe, or I knew, I always call it the one sober Irishman argument, you know, of if you say something on St. Patrick's Day, like, hey, the Irish are drinking people. There's always one guy in the room says, oh, I knew a guy named Paddy O'Reilly. He never took a drink. Well, OK, that's true, but it's statistically meaningless. And I think in part it comes from the fact that we do so many more things alone these days, that we are just such a solitary, that we read, you know, we watch TV alone, that we read the internet alone, that we just do a lot of things alone, and we don't have other people there contradicting us or serving as a reality check. And I think that combined with, you know, the kids who always get a trophy where no answer is wrong, we've reached a bad place in our society where, you know, you really can't tell people anything. I mean, it's very difficult.
Well, we shouldn't even go down the road of the – I don't even know if there was ever expertise on TV, but I imagine that's just a dumpster fire right now when you turn on any number of the daytime
talk
shows. But
– I'll give you an example from Bill Maher, a show I watched now and then. You know, I have a pretty varied diet in my
– No judgment. I don't know why you're saying it like that.
Don't judge me, man. But Maher, I mean, I was fascinated because he had on Charles Murray, who I actually admire quite a bit. And they were having an argument about something factual. And Murray said, Bill, there is no point in arguing over things we can look up. And Murray said, you are wrong about what you think. And Maher said, okay, well, I still don't believe you. And I thought, that's what it's come to, that, you know, Charles Murray, who's written a book the size of a cinder block on this issue, says to a comedian on national television, you're wrong. This fact you believe in is wrong. And the guy shrugs his shoulders and says, well, I still don't believe you. That's what it's like to be an expert in the 21st century, is that people shrug and go, yeah, whatever. I don't believe you.
The problem is he didn't bring in the guy with the opposing opinion with his cinder block book. So... you know, that should have been the strategy. Be like, I don't want to speak for myself.
Don't need that guy. Well, people don't need that guy. They simply believe that what they know is good enough. And it's really frightening. I mean, there is a – thank God for David Dunning and Justin Kruger who have
– you didn't bring that – I'm surprised you didn't bring that up yet, and I totally forgot to ask it. Yeah, absolutely. Please continue.
The Dunning-Kruger effect finally has a name, and it's something we've all experienced. But what Dunning and Kruger, who are political psychologists, they couldn't figure out, why is it that dumb people don't know they're dumb? And what they found was actually the opposite, that the dumber you are, the more likely you are to think you're not dumb. And they said it's their experiments done repeatedly and now imitated widely by other investigators is that people, they call them less competent people, which I think is a wonderful euphemism. Their answer is basically that you lack metacognition. That is, you lack the ability to know you're doing something poorly. The best metaphor is that if you're tone deaf, you don't know that you're a bad singer. You know, it sounds okay to you. If you're a bad writer, you think that you're a pretty good writer because it looks okay to you on the page. And that is, you know, rampant. It's like there's an epidemic of this Dunning-Kruger business out there, and it makes being an expert extraordinarily difficult.
Well, I wonder how much of that comes from the the rise of the it's a variation of the service economy, because I think, see, there you go, I'm already going down this bramble path. I have no idea how to fix my engine, so to a certain point, there are fields that don't allow this effect to have an impact, and maybe there was just more people in society engaged in these tasks, and now you have a lot of people in, you know, business, for example, that they're all doing some sort of administration, or they're doing concept development, and they say, I do a lot of thinking during the day, so I'm an expert in thinking about stuff, and this is what I think.
There is some of that. I mean, one place where you can't do it are in things that have obvious markers of success or failure. You can believe all day long that you're a good golfer, but when you finally put a box of balls into the woods and you're not even at the turn yet, you know, you just have to kind of come to the realization that you're just not good at this. What a lot of these studies have found is that it's a combination of things, that people are, in fact, as you point out, in jobs where failure is not obvious right away, where they, you know, that they can, I mean, again, they're not building bridges that fall down. They're not driving buses that crash. The other problem they found is that people are increasingly unwilling to tell others that they're not good at something. And I think that that is part of a general atmosphere of, I think some of it's political correctness and some of it is a sort of general sensitivity about telling people they're not good at stuff. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, it was people, I can remember people getting fired. I mean, you know, they just weren't good at it. And your manager would come in and say, this isn't your bailiwick. Maybe you shouldn't be doing this. Now we try every which way to not tell people that. And Dunning and Kruger both point that out. But yeah, some of it is also, you know, that just social standards about a lot of things have slipped. If you're a secretary who can't compose a letter very well, a lot of the people who are reading it probably don't know it was poorly written either. So there is a lot of that kind of double failure, that the person doing poor work doesn't know it, the person getting the poor work is not quite clear on it themselves, or they're not good at it, or they're hesitant to say so. But it is a remarkable thing. I mean, it is amazing to watch people tell you that they're good at something when they're definitely not good at something. And I just it's just an astonishing thing.
I've definitely broken through the time ceiling here of how long I said that I'd keep you. But before we depart, as with every other podcast, open forum. Is there, however you want to end the podcast, you can plug where your book's going to be coming out. You can plug any blogs that you're on, any classes that you teach that people would recommend, thoughts that you have, whatever you want. You've got about, you know, 2-3 minutes to just say stuff into the microphone that you think is of value to the audience or potentially to you, so people will send dollars your way to purchase a book. But the floor is yours.
Well, what an unbelievably tempting 120 seconds to simply self-promote and talk about one's own awesomeness. I won't do that. I'll certainly give your listeners some contact information, but I'll try to leave them with a more useful thought, which is there's nothing wrong with not being an expert in every field. And there's nothing wrong with saying the words, I don't know. The most important thing
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, one of the most important things I was taught when I first got my first teaching gig, I went to one of the senior professors in my department back then at Georgetown. And I said, look, what's the best advice you can give me about teaching? And he said, never be afraid to say, I don't know. The students don't expect you to know everything. And if you say that you do, they'll know you're lying. And it's just a bad habit. So just get comfortable with saying, I don't know. And I think that's the best advice I can give to a lot of folks. If they want to follow me on Twitter, my Twitter handle is at Radio Free Tom, all one word. The book is available at Amazon for pre-order. It's called The Death of Expertise from Oxford University Press. And most of my writing is usually found at thefederalist.com or occasionally at National Interest, now and then in the Daily Beast. But if you're not a regular Federalist reader, I recommend it to your listeners and hope to see them there.
Well, excellent. Professor, it's been an absolute pleasure. And of course, I say professor is an honorarium, obviously. But really, really, thanks for joining us on I'm losing my expertise in pronunciation here at the end of the show again. It's been a great pleasure. Thanks for coming on with us at short notice. Okay, there, I got it out. I'll probably edit that out a little bit. Probably not. We'll see. But really, it's been a pleasure, and hopefully there's a lot that folks can use here.
It's a lot of fun being with you, Matthew. Thank you for the invitation, and thanks for having me on.
And hopefully sometime we'll get you on less about the concept of expertise, and we can start picking your brain about some of those topics that you are an expert in sometime in the future.
Be my pleasure.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you much.
Take care.